Genesis chapter 15, the chapter which we just read, falls into two parts. First, verses 1 to 6, which we looked at last week, and then verses 7 to 21, which we will consider this morning. The structure of these two parts is similar. First of all, the Lord makes a promise to Abraham. Second, Abraham asks a question about that promise. And then the Lord explains the promise more fully. You see this, for instance, in the first six verses. The Lord promises Abraham, "I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." Verse 1. Then Abraham says, "Lord, I'm childless. How are you going to fulfill this promise?" Verses 2 and 3. And then the Lord takes him outside, shows him the stars, and says, "So shall thy seed be." And there's a similar arrangement in the second part of the chapter. The Lord says in verse 7, "I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it." And then Abraham asks the question, "Lord, how do I know that I'm going to inherit this land?" And in the remainder of the chapter, the Lord makes that promise clearer and, if possible, surer. Now, in these two different parts of the chapter, the blessing is brought out in a slightly different way. In the first six verses, the seed of Abraham is the issue. Then God explains to us the truth of justification by faith alone. In verses 7 to 21, it's not so much the seed that's the issue, it's the land which is the issue. And there we have a treatment not of justification, but of God's covenant. Now let's look at the opening verses of our text, verses 7 to 21. In verse 7, the Lord promises Abraham the land, and then he gives him two further assurances that he will inherit it. "I am the Lord that brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it." The first promise, the first assurance rests on who God is. "I am the Lord. I'm the great Jehovah. I'm the self-existent, unchangeable, faithful God. I will give you the land." And the second assurance rests on what the Lord has already done for Abraham. "I'm the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees. I sent to you a call which came not only in word, but in power, Abraham. And I brought you out with a specific purpose that I might give you this land. Now then, do you think that I, the faithful Jehovah, brought you out in order not to give you this land and have my promise fall to the ground?" Abraham then asks, "Whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it?" That's his question. And we need to point out that there are two different ways to ask a question of God after God gives you a promise. In Luke chapter 1, you can ask the way of Zechariah. The Lord promised Zechariah, "You're going to have a son." Zechariah says, "Well, look, I'm past the age. My wife's past the age. How's this going to happen?" And the angel Gabriel says, "I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. And now you're going to be dumb for not believing my word." That's one way of asking in unbelief. There's another way of asking, that of Hezekiah in 2 Kings chapter 20. Hezekiah is sick. God tells him, "You're going to recover." And then Hezekiah asks out of faith, "Lord, can you give me a sign of this?" And then the sun goes back 10 degrees. Now Abraham is asking out of faith like Hezekiah and not out of unbelief like Zechariah. He's saying in effect, "Lord, I believe the promise. You are going to give me the land. I want to believe more strongly. Help my weak faith. Give me further proofs and demonstrations that I shall inherit the land. Lord, whereby shall I know that I really know that I'm going to inherit?" Now this land about which Abraham is here asking, is it the land of Palestine? Well, yes, in a sense, it's the land of Palestine. But it's the land of Palestine only as a picture of something better. That's the significance of Palestine. In Romans chapter 4, verse 13, the apostle teaches that the promise to Abraham was, quote, "that he should be the heir of the world." read that in Genesis. They are the world. Well, that's what Paul says. This is the promise. The land of Canaan is the promise of the whole world. It's explained further in Hebrews 11, verse 16, that Abraham desired an heavenly country. So, Canaan's in the foreground here, but Canaan is the whole world, and Canaan is a heavenly world. That's what Abraham looked for and desired, because that's what he believed God was promising him. And the application to us is very obvious. This is the main line running through verses 7 to 21 for us. We're not going to inherit this earthly land of Canaan, nor do we particularly want the earthly land of Canaan either. Our question today is, how can we be more convinced that when we die, we will be with Christ in heaven? How can we be sure that one day we, with the whole Catholic Church, will inherit the new heavens and the new earth? And the answer to that question is, this is the answer that God gave to Father Abraham, the answer to that question is the covenant. That's how you can be sure. The covenant. Abraham asks, verse 8, how do I know that I'm going to inherit it? And then the remainder of the chapter is the covenant. God teaches them about the covenant. And this is the first use of the word covenant, verse 18, in the Abrahamic narrative. Psalm 25 says, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will teach them his covenant. And here he's coming to teach his covenant to Abraham who fears him, to the intent that Abraham might know that he really will inherit the land. And this is God's method in all the ages in teaching his people about the surety of their inheritance. I'm going to teach you about my covenant. And the greater our vision of the covenant, the more sure we will be that we will be with Christ in heaven at death, and that we will inherit the whole world. And that's our subject for the sermon this morning. Abraham's vision of the covenant. Abraham's vision of the covenant. First, we're going to look at the nature of the covenant bond, then the future of the covenant people, and then the extent of the covenant land. Quite a bit there. Abraham's vision of the covenant, the nature of the covenant bond, the future of the covenant people, and the extent of the covenant land. Now, in order for God to teach Abram the truth of the covenant, to assure him of the certainty of his inheritance, God gave Abraham some directions for a covenant ceremony. At God's instruction, Abraham took three animals and two birds. The animals were a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old she-goat, and a three-year-old ram. The two birds, there was a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Abraham took those animals and then he cut them in two. The heifer, the she-goat, and the ram were divided in two. And the two birds, well, they're small anyway, and they were merely killed and put one over against the other. And then Abraham arranged these carcasses, half of the heifer there, half of the heifer over there, the same thing with the she-goat, and then the same thing with the ram and the turtle dove over against the young pigeon. So that there's a way right through the middle of the carcasses that someone can walk between them. And then with all these dead animals lying around, the birds came. Think of the vultures descending on these mutilated animals. And Abraham comes out and he scares the birds away, shoos them away, because he doesn't want them pecking away at the dead flesh. And then when the sun was going down, not when the sun was down, we'll see the significance of that later on, but when the sun was going down, picture sort of half of it above the horizon, another half below it. When the sun was going down, Abraham fell asleep. He didn't fall asleep with the idea that, well, it's night time and you get tired and you usually fall asleep that time. But Abraham fell into a deep sleep, a supernatural, divinely induced sleep, fast asleep. Something similar to the sleep of Adam, when God put Adam asleep in the Garden of Eden and then performed that operation and took out the rib and formed for Adam his wife. The sun was going down and Abraham's asleep. More time passes, and the sun now is not merely going down, the sun has set. It's gone down. And so verse 17 tells us it is dark. And Abraham now, he's still sleeping, he's in this deep sleep. And verse 17 says, behold, something particularly important at this point, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp passed between the pieces. Now that's the ceremony. What's going on in these verses? Well, we need to point out before we look at that, that this is emphatically a covenant-making ceremony. A covenant-making ceremony. Verse 18 says, in the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Then we should turn to Jeremiah chapter 34. Jeremiah chapter 34, verses 18 to 20. A similar type of covenant-making ceremony went on in Jerusalem in the days of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 34, verse 14, I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant which they have made before me, when they cut the calf in twain, and passed between the parts thereof. Similar to Genesis chapter 15. The princes of Judah, the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs, the priests, and all the people of the land passed between the parts of the calf. And remember, this is a covenant, verse 18 says. And then, since they broke this covenant, I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life, and their dead bodies shall be meat unto the fowls of the heaven and to the beasts of the earth. The question then is, what does this covenant-making ceremony teach us about God's covenant? And all this, of course, with a view to answering Abraham's question, how will I really know that I'm going to inherit the land? The first, the most obvious thing this teaches us is that God's covenant is unilateral. That is, it is made by him alone, unilateral. The first three letters, U-N-I, one. God's covenant is unilateral. And Jeremiah 34 teaches us that in covenants between men, both parties walk between the dead bodies. And the striking thing about Genesis 15, and it would have been even more striking to those familiar with the ceremonies of the ancient world, the striking thing about Genesis chapter 15 is that God alone walks through the carcasses. And you say, well, what about Abraham? Wasn't the covenant between God and Abraham? Yes, it was. But what about Abraham? Well, Abraham, he's sleeping. He is in a deep sleep. And here, God teaches us through Father Abraham something vital about the covenant in which we are God's friends. God makes a covenant with us, and we're all fast asleep. That's the way God makes a covenant with us. Fast asleep. God established this covenant at the cross of Jesus Christ some 1900 years and it varies from individual here, but some 1900 years before you were born. So you're not only sleeping, you don't even exist. In fact, if we want to go back even further, God decreed the covenant before the creation came into being. None of your ancestors were alive. The universe wasn't there. Not only were you sleeping, but you didn't even exist. And the truth that God alone walked through the pieces when Father Abraham was asleep rules out the theory that the covenant is a contract or a bargain or a treaty, because Abraham was asleep. And he wasn't even talking in his sleep. He was in a deep sleep, completely out cold. And Abraham made no contract, he formed no bargain, because he was asleep. And men do not make bargains when they're asleep. If you're in a business and you're making some deal for your boss, he will not send you out to make a contract when you're asleep. You've got to be awake to make a contract or an agreement. And if the covenant was a contract, then you see, if this wouldn't fit. It wouldn't even fit from this covenant ceremony. But it wouldn't even be an answer to Abraham's question. Because the question is, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit the land? And then if God were to say, well, the covenant, it's sort of like a contract to Abraham. here, let's bring in a couple of books, and you can sign your part, and I'll sign my part, like we do at these great international treaties. But if it were a contract, then that wouldn't have helped Abraham, because Abraham would have forfeited the covenant and the land already, because Abraham was a sinner. Father Abraham was a sinner. And Father Abraham, at the end of Genesis 12, had already left the land, and he'd gone down into Egypt. As far as was in him, he'd forfeited the covenant. And if you take this to the present day, it'd be a bit like a minister comforting a dying soul. The soul's fearful of death. Understandable, too. It says, what will happen to me when I die? Read me from the Bible. I want to be sure. Comfort me. And you say, oh, let me tell you about the covenant. I'll tell you about the covenant. It's a contract. It's all about what God does and what you do. And have you kept your part? And you'd look back in your life, and death would certainly focus your concentration a lot more than it does now. You'd say, well, no, I didn't. No, I look back in my life and I can see God's grace at work, but I think mostly of my own sins. And I'm going over the penitential psalms on my deathbed. And that was not really going to give any man much comfort, that this covenant is a contract. You're going to drive this man to despair if you say to him, think of all the good things that you've done and how faithful you've been in your life, because no matter how worthy that saint's going to be, he's going to see all sorts of reasons for despair. But instead, we preach to you the absolute certainty of the covenant of grace, that absolutely all of God's elect will inherit the world to come. Why? Because God alone establishes and maintains the covenant. God alone walks through the carcasses. And we're all fast asleep. Fast asleep. And that's the best state for man when God's making a covenant with us. And God puts us to sleep in regard to the establishment and maintenance of his covenant. And that's how you know, believer, that's how you know that one day when you die, you'll be in heaven, even though it seems absolutely preposterous that people like us could be with God. And that's how you know, too, that one day, the world in which you live, one day you will own that world, and your feet will stand in the new heavens and the new earth. And that, I dare say, sounds even more preposterous, because the covenant rests in God alone. We must believe that, and be like Father Abraham. And we can go further by asking ourselves the question, what is the idea of God walking through the dead animals? The idea is that God promises that if he breaks the covenant, he will be torn in pieces. You say, that doesn't make sense. How can God break the covenant? He's the unchangeable, faithful God of truth. How can he break his covenant? Well, of course, how can he break his covenant? And how can a God who is self-existent and immaterial be torn in pieces? How can you tear an immaterial, spiritual, infinite, exalted, perfect, blessed God in pieces? How can you do that? Exactly. And God is hereby teaching us the absolute certainty that we will be in heaven. The absolute certainty that we will be in heaven rests not in your good works or even in your faith. It rests in the very being of God, especially his truthfulness and his being spirit. And so if God then breaks his word, he has pledged that he will destroy himself. And that can never be. To put it slightly differently, the living God says that I would rather die than break my covenant with you. I would rather die than have it that when you die, you perish, or that you will not be raised up on the last day and stand in the new heavens and the new earth. As Christ said, the meek will inherit the earth. And that means every child of God. And so it's a good job then that Father Abraham and the elect in general did not walk through the pieces of these animals, because then we would have been torn in pieces many times because we sin and we're unfaithful. We say that it's a good job that Father Abraham was asleep. And how did he come to be asleep? God put him asleep. He says, Abraham, I'm going to make this really clear to you. Sleep. And Abraham fell into a deep sleep. In fact, so great is God's commitment to his covenant with us that he actually gave his own son to be broken in pieces for our sins. He was despised and spit upon and beaten and whipped and slain. And in the Lord's Supper, Jesus Christ says to his church, "Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you." And so God's covenant with us is unbreakable and indissoluble. King David said centuries later that God has made a covenant with him even though he's been unfaithful and his house hasn't been so with God as it should have been. He said, "God established a covenant with me, established in all things and sure." And this covenant which God makes with the elect children of Abraham in Jesus Christ is unbreakable in its establishment at its very beginning, and it's unbreakable in its maintenance to the very end. That's the way it was with Father Abraham. God made this covenant with Father Abraham in Genesis 15 that he would inherit the land, future, not just for that instance, but for all of Abraham's life and all of his existence. "I make this covenant with you now," Genesis 15, "that you will inherit the land." And therefore, the covenant from beginning to end is unbreakable from beginning to end, because God alone is the one who passed through the pieces. So we will inherit the earth, even though your flesh, even when you hear this word, says, hard to believe that. The being of God is pledged to it in his covenant. That's the first main argument that God uses to answer Abraham's question. But in order that Abraham would be even more assured that he and his seed would inherit the land, God then outlines for Abraham and for the church of all ages the future of God's covenant people. This is found in verses 13 to 16. The first part, verse 13, we could say is bondage in Egypt. Bondage in Egypt. And Israel here, God's people, could be said to be three different things. First, strangers. "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs." You're not going to own this land, you'll be foreigners and sojourners. Secondly, you'll not only be strangers, but you will be slaves. You'll be strangers in this land, and you shall serve them. And then thirdly, not only strangers and slaves, but sufferers. They shall afflict them 400 years. And this is exactly what happened. In the days of Jacob, he and the 70 went south from the land of Canaan. Read about this in the last few chapters of Genesis. And became strangers in the land of Egypt. And then they multiplied and grew. And there rose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And he made them slaves. They built Python and Ramesses, Pharaoh's great building projects, out of brick. And then they became sufferers. The bondage became harder and more rigorous. You can't have straw. We're going to throw your male children into the River Nile. All mapped out. And the period given here in the text, verse 13, is 400 years. There's another reference in another place, two other places, to 430 years. And the question is, when does this 400 years start and when does it end? That's a harder question. We'll pass that by for the moment. And Abraham here, in this dream, in this sleep, verse 12, we're told that an horror of great darkness fell upon him. He's in a deep sleep, and in his sleep, a horror of great darkness comes upon him. And this is especially indicative of what was going to happen to his seed. They're going to be strangers. They're going to be slaves. They're going to suffer and be afflicted in this foreign land. A horror of great darkness. Did Abraham know which land his seed were going to be servants and sufferers in? We're not told. God didn't tell him here. Maybe he wondered about it. Wonder what nation that could be. Could it be somewhere in the north? Paddan Aram? Maybe will we go back to Ur of the Chaldees? Huh, will it be Egypt? He wasn't sure. Jacob, whenever he journeyed south at Joseph's behest, He may well have wondered, is this what's the next event? We're all going to be slaves down here. But God told him to go, and so he went. And the children of Israel, in the days of their bondage in Egypt, forgot about this. They should have remembered when they were making bricks, God's promise, this must be the land. We're strangers here, we're slaves, now we're suffering. Genesis 15, the promise to Abraham, but they didn't remember. But God did. Here's Exodus 6, verses 4 and 5. I established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. And I have remembered my covenant. And I have especially remembered the covenant I made in Genesis 15, that I told them that I would bring them out. And verse 14 of Genesis 15 tells us about what we call the Exodus. God says, I'm going to judge the nation which afflicted them. And we know, for the book of Exodus, that he judged them with the 10 plagues. And when they come out, and they will come out, that's what the word Exodus means, coming out. When they come out, they will come out with great substance. And we know that the great substance with which they exited the country was the jewelry of the Egyptians. God told them, ask the Egyptians for their jewelry. And the Egyptians said, sure, take it, get out of here. And they took it, and they left with the jewelry. In a sense, the wages for which they'd labored all those years, making Pharaoh's great cities. Verse 16, we've had the bondage in Egypt, the Exodus. Verse 16 deals with the conquest of Canaan. My term, not specifically mentioned in the text. After leaving the land of their captivity, they would come to Canaan. Because the text says, in the fourth generation they shall come hither again. That is, they're going to sojourn in this foreign land and they're going to come back here. And it says, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Implication, that the Amorites, when you take this land, will no longer be there. Now, how's that going to be? The text doesn't say. Are they going to move on? Is God going to hit them with a terrible famine and kill the whole lot of them? Could it be by warfare? Well, yes, it was by warfare. The rest of the Bible tells us this. And we're told that this would be in the fourth generation. And many point out that there were four generations from Levi to Moses in which the people of God were in Egypt. And then God points out to Abram that before this bondage in Egypt, and before the Exodus, and before the conquest of Canaan, Abraham, you're going to be dead. You will die. And therefore, Abraham, you can work out from this, you will never actually physically possess the land in your lifetime. Because the only possession of the land comes after the conquest, and you're already dead. Abraham, verse 15, you will die at a good old age, full of days and full of piety. Abraham, you will be buried. You're not going to be hewn in pieces by the armies of Chedorlaomer or the king of Sodom. You're not going to be devoured by a wild beast. You're going to be buried. And you will go to your fathers in peace. And when it says that Abraham goes to his fathers in peace, it doesn't mean merely that he goes to the place of the dead with all who die, but it means he goes to the place of the blessed dead, where all his fathers in the faith went before him. Here it is. In Genesis 15, it's all mapped out to Father Abraham. Abraham, here are the events. You're going to die in a good old age. Then, somehow or other, your descendants are going to go into some land and become their strangers, servants, and sufferers. And then they're going to be taken out with great substance. That's the Exodus. And then they will conquer Canaan. And God does this and reveals this truth to Abraham as the one who passed between these broken, dismembered animal carcasses. As the smoking furnace, the God who brought his people into a furnace in Egypt and made them suffer. And then too as the one who is the burning lamp, who is a light to them in the dark place. And God often revealed himself that way too. At the burning bush, Mount Sinai, and the pillar that led them through the wilderness. Smoke and fire. That's the revelation of God in his word. So here in Genesis chapter 15, we have an outline of biblical history from Genesis to Joshua, the first six books of the Bible. And so this chapter of Father Abraham outlines the future of the covenant people for several hundred years. And all of this, too, is a basic model for the lives of all the children of Abraham. The bondage of sin. That's the first thing. And then there's redemption from the bondage of sin in the blood of Jesus Christ. And then, after we die, like Father Abraham, then there's Canaan, the heavenly Canaan. And in fact, when the iniquity of not just the Amorites, but the iniquity of the world is full, then Christ will return to judge the world, and all the wicked will be slaughtered. Joshua will come from heaven and wipe out the Canaanites completely. There'll be no pockets left. And then the new heavens and the new earth. And this too is sure, because this is included in the one covenant in Genesis chapter 15. Because God alone went through the carcasses. And he went through the carcasses alone for this too. And therefore the covenant is unilateral. God alone makes it. And unbreakable. Because God isn't going to cut himself in pieces. And so we return to the question at the very beginning. How do you know that you and the whole Christian church will be glorified and inherit the earth? Well, you say, according to the mapping out of the history of God's people in Genesis 15, you could say, God has promised that he will guide me by his counsel and afterward receive me to glory. Bondage, redemption, and Canaan. That's why verse 13 begins God's speech to Abram. Know of a surety that thy seed, and so on. Know of a surety. And the Hebrew word here is know, used twice. Abraham, know, and Abraham, know this. That not only will you inherit the land, but I'm going to tell you all the steps that your seed's going to go to until you inherit the promised land. And then God says, as a third thing, my final point this morning, that I want you to be so sure, because you asked for it, Abraham, and I'm coming to resolve your doubts, I want you to be so sure that you inherit the land, that I'm going to map it out for you. I'm going to tell you exactly what your seed will inherit. And in verse 18, we have the fullest description of the covenant land so far. God gives Abraham the boundaries. Your land will run from the river of Egypt to the south and west to the river Euphrates in the north and east. And David and Solomon exercised lordship over this large tract of land at the very height of Israel's power. And God says, secondly, I've given you some geographical boundaries, I'm going to tell you 10 peoples whom your seed will dispossess. And those are found in verses 19 to 21. The first three begin with the letter K. The Kenites, Moses' father-in-law, he was a Kenite, and so part of his clan or nation or tribe would be in the land of Canaan at that time. They'll be wiped out. The Kenizzites and the Kadmonites, they're mentioned only here in all the Word of God. And then there are seven others, verses 20 to 21, more familiar names to us because they're mentioned more often in other places. Three and seven is 10. 10 is often used for completeness. That may well be the idea here. You're going to completely wipe out all these nations. And the extent of the covenant land, as I've pointed out earlier, for us today, is first of all the heavenly Canaan, Hebrews chapter 11, and then secondly and finally and eternally, the whole world, Romans 4 and verse 13. And that's all in God's covenant too. Verse 18. In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land. And then you say, what? What's the tense there? It doesn't say, unto thy seed will I give this land. God changes the tenses and he says, Abraham, you want to know how you'll inherit the land. God said, well, I've already given it to you. I have given you the land. In my decree, in the cross of Christ, in my promise. By inheritance, by title, it is yours. That's too how you know it. And this whole chapter, as I said in the title of this morning's sermon, this whole chapter describes for us Abraham's vision of the covenant. And vision can mean, you know, he saw this, it was a grand thing in his heart, he had it before him. And also vision is used in the very first word, very first verse of the chapter. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abraham in a vision. We usually associate visions and dreams. A dream is a special revelation from God when you're asleep. A vision is like a dream, only you're awake. And this vision consists of the whole of Genesis chapter 15. In fact, it's the first vision that is mentioned in the Bible. And you say, well, why could God not just simply enact this history? Why do we have to have a vision? And I believe the answer is that Abraham in this vision is asleep. And so Abraham then, by God, is given a vision, and he can see himself asleep. He can see everything going on in the vision, so it's clear to him. If it hadn't been a vision, then Abraham would have to be told afterwards, when God tapped him on the shoulder and woke him up, Abraham, by the way, I was the only one that walked through those pieces. You didn't see it. And rather than have it like that, God gave the whole thing in a vision. And so Abraham can see himself in the vision, cutting up these animals, putting them in order, himself falling into a deep sleep, and then God in the furnace and the torch passing between the pieces. And you say, well, why is the whole chapter then a vision? Because, according to your explanation here, the vision is most important and necessary for Abraham, the bit where Abraham's asleep. Why the whole thing in a vision when verses 1 to 6 don't necessarily have to be? I think the idea is that the whole of Genesis chapter 15 is a great unity. The first 6 verses which talk about the seed and justification, that's a unity with the bit that talks about the land and the covenant. Seed and land is one promise. And justification and covenant, they're all of a piece too. And Abraham, here's your vision of the covenant. Here it is. You're righteous by faith alone. I'm going to give you a seed. I'm going to give you a land. And here's how you're going to know it. I'm the God who alone passed through the dead carcasses. Believe it. Amen.